Well, we'll say here hello to Russ Cooper. Mr. Cooper, thanks for talking with us.
No problems. Good morning.
Maybe talk for a second about True Secure and about what you do.
Well, as Surgeon General of True Secure, it's my job to try and promote public safety on the Internet and take our company's philosophy of mitigating risks in order to ensure security as far along into the public as possible.
Mm-hmm. And do mostly you deal with businesses and people who have large networks and so forth?
Yes, in general we do. I run a free public mailing list called NTBugTrack that gives as much information as we can to anybody who's interested in hearing about it.
Okay. And here in the studio, Bob Forsch and Mark Zinzo. Bob, what do you do in your capacity as coordinator of security, computer security for campus?
Well, it is falls to me to take care of the incident response for campus when the network people or other sources alert us to particular machines that have problems. It is my task as well as my staff's to go ahead and get out to the departments and inform them of this. And in some cases, we in an active attack situation, let's say, we would go ahead and filter those machines so that they could do no more damage on the Internet.
Okay. And CCSO, what is the function of this office?
Well, actually, I'm with the Operations Center in CCSO, whose primary mission is to support network administrators, and I've been working in our network administrator support group for a couple years. And as part of my responsibility to make sure that network administrators have the necessary tools, I've been working with the campus site license for antivirus software and making sure that the virus fighters on campus have the necessary tools. So I've been looking very closely at antivirus software.
Okay. Let's maybe we can talk for a moment again about Code Red, which is just sort of the latest problem that's come along. And I think that probably there are people, particularly people who aren't familiar with computers, might still be a little unsure what exactly this is and what it does. So maybe one of you could give a real basic explanation of what it is and where it came from. Maybe we'll ask Mark to do that, and anybody else wants to comment after that can do that.
Well, let me start with some very basics. The Code Red is a worm, and I think for people that are new to computers, understanding the difference between a virus and a worm is important in understanding how these things work. The Code Red worm can infect your system and go on to degrade networks and infect other systems without any intervention whatsoever on your part. Whereas a virus, you have to actually trigger the virus for it to happen. You know, a lot of email viruses, you have to open the attachment before the virus can be unleashed, in the sense that you have to have intimate contact with somebody to catch a biological virus. You know, somebody has to at least sneeze in your face or you know, not wash your hands and shake hands or whatever, the way we pass a cold virus. With a computer virus, the viruses are dormant until they're activated, until you actually execute a program to which that virus is attached. Whereas a worm, it can sort of crawl from one system to another on its own, taking advantages of the network connections and the vulnerabilities on that system. And this is essentially what the Code Red worm does. It takes advantage of some security flaws that got past Microsoft's testing. Microsoft has released about once a month, sometimes twice a month, major bulletins about drastically major security problems with their software, and this worm is taking advantage of some of those to break into your system. So if you aren't patching your system on a regular basis with the latest Microsoft security updates, you're vulnerable.
Russ,
and you're connected to the Internet.
Maybe I'll ask you this question. Do people know where this came from?
Not the first three versions of the worm. I would just add one little clarification to what a worm is or what this worm is. This is just like somebody coming to your website and asking for any page that you might have on your website. That's how this worm gets to your computer. Even though you don't have the page that it's asking for, it uses that method to get there. Trying to track down who this is, we have a pretty good idea who this latest variant came from, the one on Saturday. We just as a little background, TruSecure Corporation certifies all antivirus software, and we're the only company in the world that does that. So we help to establish what antivirus software should or shouldn't do. This worm, because it isn't actually coming in the normal methods, it's coming as a web page request, isn't something that most antivirus software looks for. A couple of companies have released things that will detect it once it's already on your computer, but they don't look for it as it's getting there. Mm-hmm. They do in the case of email and other ways. But as far as figuring out who did the first version, and really they were the ones that sort of opened the door to abuse this, it's probably going to be impossible to ever figure them out. This latest version comes from a group who likes to brag, and so as a result, it's far easier to figure out who wrote it. Plus, it's a more sophisticated program this time. The first ones were pretty crude in the way they operated. This one is a bit more sophisticated, and so we can see programming style and technique in this one that we've seen in others from the same group.
Mm. Well, so given the fact, as you just said, if most antivirus programs can't detect this, then what does one do to protect yourself against it?
Well, first of all, this isn't going to have any effect on most computers for people on a campus, for example, or the average person at home. If you're running Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows Millennium Edition, a Macintosh computer, then you're completely unaffected by this other than the consumption of bandwidth. Your internet connection might get slower because these things that are attacking have no idea who they're attacking. They'll attack everybody and anybody. So you may get attacked, but there's actually the tools on your computer aren't there to allow this thing to work. So if you're running a web server, generally you wouldn't be running other programs on your web server that would involve the potential for viruses. So in this case, since a worm is not something that you would normally detect by an antivirus product anyway, you would have to detect this based on the actions of your computer. So there's a program that you can run on your computer that will tell you what all network connections you're currently making and have been made to you, and by running that, you could see that you are making outbound connections when your web server normally would only be accepting inbound connections. And when you see that rise, then you would know that you are now participating in the attack and therefore have been affected. We prefer instead, there's an easier way for you to go and check, and that's to check whether you're vulnerable. Because if you check first whether you're vulnerable, and you are, you can fix it. Whether you're participating in the attack or not, that check should be made.
Mm-hmm. Has this, let me turn to Bob, has this caused any problems that you have seen on the U of I campus here in Urbana-Champaign?
Well, I'd say that we've had our fair share in the last month or so. There's probably been maybe a couple hundred machines. We get more and more detected as time goes on, but we are working with network administrators to address that sort of problem.
Maybe I'll take the second here real quick to introduce everybody. We're talking here this morning about internet security and safe computing issues, and we're certainly open to your questions. Joining us by phone, Russ Cooper, who is Surgeon General at TruSecure, which is a computer security company. Bob Forsch is here, who's Coordinator of Campus Security for Computing here on the U of I campus, and Mark Zinso. He's a research programmer with the Computing and Communications Services Office on U of I campus. And questions are welcome. That's really one of the reasons that we're here. If you'd like to call in, have a particular question, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And having read some stories about this, what's kind of striking is that it seems that the party that people have chosen to be irritated with is Microsoft, because they say that this particular Code Red deal takes advantage of a problem with the Microsoft product, and they say Microsoft should have gone over it with the proverbial fine-tooth comb and found that and never let that get out. And they say that at least as far as something like this is concerned, that this really is a software manufacturing issue, and they're the ones that truly are at fault. Is that fair?
I can argue both sides of that.
You take the non-Microsoft side, and I'll take the Microsoft side.
Well, the non-Microsoft side is that this applies to vendors other than just Microsoft. With the increasing pressure to get products to market quickly, it's harder and harder to do rigorous testing, long beta periods where these things can crop up, and it, you know, it's hard to get enough programmers to carefully review their code with security implications in mind. You know, the security people may be off in one corner of the company, and they're not going to look at every line of code that every programmer produces everywhere else in the company. And so it is a very difficult challenge when you have something as large and complex as the Microsoft operating system to prevent these kind of things. And it's also very difficult once they have a fix. There's about a month lead time before it shows up in their automatic updates as they test that the fix doesn't cause more problems than the problem it solves. So while they release it immediately for the technical elite who know to look at the Microsoft security bulletins or subscribe to a newsletter such as NT BugTrack to find out about it right away, you know, if your average person has decided to run NT or Windows 2000 because it's more stable than Windows 9X, and they just rely on Windows Update to tell them when they need to fix something, they're not going to get it. So in that sense, Microsoft is not good at notifying the average consumer that chooses to use their higher-end products. And you know, they have the same challenges that other companies have. Although I heard something interesting. We had a security expert on campus give a lecture a few months ago, Gene Spafford, who sort of wrote the definitive paper on the Morris Internet worm a long time ago. And he said that actually it's going to be insurance that forces Microsoft to either lose market share or clean up their act, because the cost of insuring data centers against downtime is just going to be a purely economic factor as reliability becomes a greater factor.
While I love staff, I don't think insurance companies are going to make as much of a difference as some of them would like to think. But there's blame to go around to virtually everybody involved in this, unfortunately. Microsoft responds to market demand and provides features in their products that the market demands. They also want to provide the functionality that the market expects, which is that I turn the computer on and I can do everything that I've been told I could do, and should be able to do 10 things that I wasn't told I could do as well. So in that respect, they provide the product to the customer in the way the customer wants it, in the way the OEMs, the Dells and Compaqs of the world want to deliver it to those customers. And usually that's focused around reduced support costs. So the wider open it is when I get it up and running, the more likely it is I'll be able to achieve what I'm trying to do and I won't call for support. But the public as well has got to accept a certain amount of blame, because they have realized for a long time, I hope, that they've got a very sophisticated and powerful piece of equipment in front of them. And they've chosen not to do much in terms of learning how to use it or how to use it properly or what things should or shouldn't be done. They've accepted many of the myths of the Internet, that it's a free, anonymous, open place to do absolutely anything and everything that you ever wanted to do without any form of responsibility of whether or not your computer is or isn't harming it. And so they sit back and expect that somebody is going to push something down to their computer that will fix everything and make it not be bad or be secure or protect their privacy or whatever. And in reality, because of the level of development that we're at right now with the Internet, I mean, we're in its raw infancy, embryonic stage almost, none of that is true. I mean, yeah, you could expect that to happen, and some people pretend to make that happen, but in fact, it really is incumbent upon the user themselves to take the steps necessary to protect themselves and protect others from them.
Mm. Well, just with this particular problem now, Microsoft has developed a fix, which they are making available free to anybody who wants it. Does that take care of the problem?
Well, let's get this into focus. Over 2 years ago, Microsoft produced a recommendation that would have prevented you from being vulnerable to this particular attack, which was first announced in June. So when it was announced in June, the fix was simultaneously announced. So the fix has been available since it was publicly announced that there was a problem. Should that have fixed it? Yes. Should people have been proactive and have applied the recommendation that even Microsoft was making 2 years ago? Definitely. But it is this, I don't think about it. I didn't even know I had the web server running on my computer. This is part of the problem why we still have boxes that are vulnerable to it now.
Mm-hmm. And that's one place where I would criticize Microsoft. The web server is installed by default in any installation of Windows 2000. And so somebody who sets up a new machine comes with Windows 2000 out of the box. They don't even know they're running a web server. There's no real notification.
I would make one correction there. That's true for Windows 2000 Server, an operating system that costs, even in the States, in excess of $300-$400, as opposed to Windows 2000 Professional, which is the desktop version that most people are likely running.
Well, most people that I've helped clean up and patch have been running 2000 Professional, and they've told me they never activated IIS.
It's not on there, then. I'm sorry. It doesn't install as part of the default installation.
Now, if you install Front Page or something like that, I know you get it, too, that way.
Certainly. Yeah, there's all kinds of ways it will get on the computer. It just doesn't get on there out of the box. And it also could be where they were buying the computers, that some of the OEM vendors pre-install options that would not normally be there as part of the default installation because they want to give their customers more features or make it appear like their machines are easier to use.
Well, it seems, it sounds, from what you're saying, it sounds to me like really one issue here that has to be confronted is that as more and more people have these machines, and I would put myself in this category of people who, and I really don't know how it works. If I have a problem, I'm one of the first guys to holler for somebody who knows to come help me. I barely know how to, which buttons to push to make it to go. And it sounds as if what you all are saying is that you really can't quite be that way. You've got to be a little bit more conscientious or at least try to keep up with these kinds of problems that might come along. And you can't just really just take the mindset that says, I know how to turn it on, I know how to get it to do the things I want, and that's really all I need to know about this machine.
There are certainly devices that are being produced today that work more like that than a personal computer. A personal computer has a lot of scope that it can cover. If you take even something like an Xbox when it comes out, it will have more limited functionality, and so there may not be quite as much to learn as there would be with a personal computer. But you're right. People do have to get a better grasp on what they have. But we, at the vendor community, has to do a much better job of explaining to you what you have and what you should do and what you shouldn't do and how you do that. I sent something out to my list a week ago that said, I tried to go and take a computer, in this case a Windows NT computer, and apply all of the fixes that I should have on this box according to all of the recommendations. And I found five different places on Microsoft's website that told me what I should do. No two alike, and none of them comprehensive. So, that's a failing grade there on getting the information to the public. So, but we have CNET offers a service, and there's another company called Big Fix that offers a service that will tell you every little thing that needs to be done, and they try and do some value add by giving you some information. These are a good step forward, but that's a far cry from the public's expectation that they should be able to just sit down at the computer and, go to a website. Mm-hmm. So we have to do a better job.
Yeah, I think, Bob, you want to...
Just wanted to chime in here that I think I tend to agree with both of the last comments that it will take a change in mindset on behalf of the user. The user is working from the perspective that if it's not broke, don't fix it. And clearly in all of these kinds of things, the user is typically the last person to know that they have a problem.
Right.
And so the mindset of... I do have this fairly powerful machine at my disposal, and I have I don't know if you want to call it a responsibility, probably for sure, that my machine is doing everything correctly, and I should take some steps as preventive maintenance or something, just like you would dust off the keyboard or wipe off the screen to get the dust off, except in Dave's case here.
Every month or two we dust. Come on.
But in preventive maintenance, one should be looking and saying, okay, what new updates are available for my machine? Some of these things will prevent problems. Others will add you more services. And typically these things are at no cost to the user. They're sort of come with the price you pay for the operating system. And so I would suggest that until the users actually have a mindset that they have a responsibility to keep current with their operating system, instead of the thinking of, it's not broke, I'm not going to touch it, I think that we're going to still have these problems.
We're about the midpoint here, and would welcome whatever questions people have. We're talking about the issue of Internet security and safe computing, and we have three guests here. Bob Forsch, the last guy you heard, coordinator of campus security, computer security issues for the U of I. Mark Zinzo is here. He is research programmer with the U of I Office of Computing and Communications Services, and joining us by telephone, Russ Cooper from True Secure. It's a computer security company. And if you have questions, you should certainly take the opportunity to talk to our guest here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, why don't we talk about what sort of the basics of what people should have, and maybe one place we could start is with antivirus software. Is this something that everybody should have on their computer?
Except for hermits. If you have no internet connection and you never exchange information with anyone else, you don't need antivirus software. However, the whole purpose for having a computer is to exchange information with other people, and so you are exchanging floppies, other media, email, and connecting to the internet. Antivirus software is only one small piece, but it's getting to the point where there are, at last count last week, there were network associates counted 58,286 viruses out there, and there's somewhere between 50 and 200 new ones coming out every week, and that's not including minor variations of existing viruses. So having an antivirus package is very important. I used to say if you practice safe computing and you don't boot from untrusted disks and you follow a few basic rules, you could get by without antivirus software. But nowadays the virus issues are too complex that you're not going to remember everything on your own, that you really need an antivirus package. And there are a lot of them out there. There are a few free ones. At antivirus.com, there's a web-based one from the Trend Micro folks. Computer Associates has a free one for personal use. And then if you're affiliated with the university has purchased one of the major vendor products for all the students, faculty, and staff at the university. And if you're not aware of that, you can easily find it from the U of I homepage by clicking on software. So an antivirus software is a key part. And then the other part with any operating system today is regular updates. And if you're running Windows, I would tell people to certainly take advantage of the Windows Update feature on a regular basis. That's the no-brainer. Eventually the protection will show up there, maybe too late, but eventually it'll show up there. And I tell people, always run the critical updates. The critical updates are the security updates that are really important. And, you don't have to pay attention to the latest Windows Media Player release or the very latest web browser. But the security updates, you really want to look at those carefully. And thankfully, Microsoft has added a utility called the Critical Update Notifier, that whenever you connect to the internet, it will look to see if there's a critical update and tell you it's time to run Windows Update. So between updating and antivirus software, the third thing that you can do is listen to shows like this and pick up a few other things that you can learn about safe computing. Just learn, how these things get from one place to another and what sort of things cause you to be vulnerable. Did you have some more comments, Russ?
Sure. I actually had the owners of Windows Update and the Microsoft Security Bulletins here at my house on the weekend, and we went over that lag time issue, and that is going to get a lot better soon. So it is a problem now, but it will get better. I would say that those are really the best ways. But I do honestly believe that you can practice safe computing if you take a few simple steps. One of them, for example, is if you use Outlook, disable the preview pane.
Mm-hmm.
And use auto preview instead, which gives you three lines of non-scriptable code. So you will only see the first three lines of the email message and read it before you open it. I get an awful lot of CIRCAM infected messages this week and other infected messages other weeks from people that I know. And so, you know, just looking at the top three lines tells me whether or not this really is an email message to me or not. And instead of being curious about what it is, just delete it. I mean, the biggest problem we have is like the I love you virus, where, you know, a whole bunch of men were telling a whole bunch of men that they loved them, and those men wanted to know why. And that curiosity is what caused that particular worm to or virus to spread as much as it did. So forget the curiosity. You know, look outside your dorm window and see what's going on out there if you're curious about something, but when it comes to computing, just delete it.
Well, I have you know, seen in a lot of the stuff that I've read references that people say they're almost to the point where if they get an email with an attachment, that it doesn't matter to them what it is, who sent it to them. It's almost to the point where even if they know the person who sent it to them, they're simply deleting it.
Well, that's a very good practice. I mean, the biggest threat that we face and have faced for the last 12 to 18 months is attachments. And you know, at TrueSecure, one of our guiding principles is to eliminate 80% of the problem with 20% of the effort. And so if you say, I'll just delete every message I get with an attachment, then you have deleted 80% of the potential for being infected with anything. You can always send an email back to the person, not as a reply to that message, because typically that will open that message up, but send a message back to the individual and say, did you just send me an attachment? I have a safe email practices FAQ up on my website at antibugtrack.com that says, you know, if you're going to send somebody an email with an attachment, then send them an email ahead of that that says that. I'm going to send you an email with an attachment, and here's what the attachment is and why I'm sending it to you. And then send them a second email that includes that attachment. If you don't know why you're receiving an attachment, then you should not be opening it, period.
We have a couple of callers. We want to find out what's on their mind. They're both in Urbana, so we'll do that, starting with the first person on line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I've sort of been following this whole virus stuff for several years, and I hear all the time about you're mentioning like Outlook Express and attachments and Microsoft Web Server and Microsoft updates, and wouldn't it be a solution to get a safe computing experience to sort of eliminate Microsoft from your computing life? Is that a good option, like, you know, Linux or the Mac OS?
What, you mean there's an alternative to Microsoft?
Oh, well, I don't know. I just wondered maybe if you're a guest.
No, I'm sorry, I'm joking.
We'll try not to go down the religious war too far, but a computer is a pencil. And if that pencil's not useful to you, then get another pencil.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, there are about 300 million people that use the same kind of pencil. And they find it an enjoyable experience. So to convince them all that they should be using something else isn't really a viable scheme. There are certainly alternatives to Outlook Express or Outlook. By the way, Outlook Express 6 will be the last version of Outlook Express to ever exist, which is a good thing. But you know, you could use Eudora as opposed to Outlook, and there's certainly more security-conscious people tend to use Eudora rather than Outlook.
And these are for people who may have no idea what we're talking about. These are email.
Sorry, yes, these are email
programs.
I personally use Outlook 2000, so I'm quite comfortable with its ability to control problems.
Yeah, I personally would like to see some alternatives to Microsoft, but it's a real chicken and the egg problem. Every software peripheral every piece of software or every device that I buy to attach to my computer comes with a driver that works with Microsoft Windows, and I'm lucky if it supports a Macintosh or a Linux system or that somebody's written a Linux driver. And in a market like that, it's very difficult for anything to compete with Microsoft. And I think having some diversity and some other solutions has the benefit that then vulnerabilities aren't as widespread. You know, it complicates the issue so that, you know, if a hacker wants to write a virus, it can generally only affect one platform, although The Microsoft Office suite generated the first major wave of cross-platform viruses with the email virus and Word document viruses.
But if we did that, Mark, we might have to double your staff over there at the help desk, right?
That's right. Everything is a two-edged sword. There's an upside and a downside to everything. I would like to see, personally, I would like to see Linux succeed in competing with Microsoft just because the competition forces everybody to be a little bit sharper about what they do.
But there was as many vulnerabilities announced about Linux over the last 12 months as there have been about Windows 2000.
Yes, but at least there are thousands of people looking at the Linux source code and combing it for new vulnerabilities. There are a lot of it's a lot easier for people to secure Linux than to secure a proprietary system that very few people have access to the source code.
I would just say, too bad that didn't cause us to have fewer vulnerabilities than Windows 2000. Mm.
I want to get back to the call here because I'm not sure we've answered your question.
Yeah, I'm just listening, but yeah, thanks for your comments.
Okay, very good. I think it's it makes me think about this whole issue of how difficult or easy it is for somebody to come along and have a competitive product to Microsoft. The Microsoft folks are always saying, hey, it's an open market. Come on, anybody can start their own company and get in here and just go toe-to-toe with us. But if you're like Microsoft and you're already are on, 80% of the machines in the world, that makes it a little difficult for somebody else to come along. And
it's only in the last 12 months that we've started to see a reduction in macro viruses, usually propagated in Microsoft Word. And the reason for that is because there are thousands of companies and individual consultants who make a living, that don't work for Microsoft, make a living writing applications, packages, or individual customized environments on macros. And it was their insistence that macros be enabled by default, be work automatically, et cetera, that helped perpetuate macros continuing to be a big virus threat. Mm-hmm. So, in Microsoft's defense, they created an industry or helped assist create an industry that makes a thriving income off of this relatively insecure feature. Now, luckily for us, they were happy to go to the new method, which is that macros have a digital signature on them, to help avoid the virus problem. But nevertheless, there was a lot of pushback when Microsoft proposed to make macros less easy to work.
Let's take another caller here. This is also Urbana. It's line two.
Hello. I would like to go back to this issue of user responsibility that you discussed a little bit ago. Over the years, I've worked with many, many people on education and use of computers and found that, the people that know what they're doing, like you guys, sometimes seem to forget that we have an average Joe there that may not be able to get their VCR to work very well, let alone have to go out and look for the documentation necessary to learn about the kinds of things that you're talking about. I think part of the problem is plain and simple. It's marketing. The companies like Microsoft that wanted spend a lot of money telling us how easy the computer is to use and lull the users into thinking that all I have to do is turn it on and use it, that's the kind of message that they get and that's what they expect. So I agree that users do have a responsibility, but I also think that the companies like Microsoft have a greater responsibility to educate the users. And I hang up and listen to any comments that you might have. Thank you.
Okay. You want to follow up on that?
I think he's absolutely right that it's definitely incumbent upon the marketing departments of companies to ensure that they're not creating false expectations. As a Canadian watching American TV as I do, I'm always amazed at what I think is false and misleading advertising that seems to go out. At the same time, I don't know about in the Chicago area, but certainly here in Canada, you're not allowed to stand on the side of the highway and hitchhike or walk down the middle of the highway. The highway is meant for cars and people that know how to drive them and so on. And, maybe there's a point where we have to say, you can get into the inside of AOL without a license, but if you're going to go out onto the Internet, then you have to show that you've been able to learn a certain amount of things.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And as you said before, there are things like Internet appliances that are much more limited in their capability that may be more suited for somebody who doesn't want to learn a whole lot about a general-purpose computer. And again, it's another one of these double-edged swords thing. A general-purpose computer can do all kinds of things, but it's much more complex and requires a significant investment in education to learn how to use it properly.
Yeah, I would just add that there is a whole other economy surrounding all the computer software stuff, and that's the training and certification efforts. At some point, the software becomes so complicated that you do have to go out and get specialized training on it and then carry around your certification, if you will. MSCE is one of the big ones that people go after. And I think the caller has brought up a valid point that, yes, there is some responsibility and there is some marketing there on the part of the software vendor. But I think that's almost mitigated by the fact that they do provide these software update things that are fairly simple to just point and click, and it'll go and download all the current stuff and update your system to the appropriate levels. So in that regard, I think all the vendors are pretty much doing the same sort of thing on that. But I would like to hear what Russ might think about this alternative economy, if you will, of training and certification.
Well, I think training and certification has its place, but I think the public perceives that as being one person amongst 50 who's had that training and certification, and then they become the translator to them to show them how they do the four things that out of the 100 things that should be done that they need to do. Someone else fix my computer, I'm going to get a coffee, is a common mentality, unfortunately. And it, to a certain extent, it should be. I mean, the public should be able to sit down at a computer in a web cafe and go to Hotmail and read their email and walk away and not have to worry that, you know, they've lost all of their privacy, or that the web cafe should worry that somebody could sit down and go and attack the internet from that computer. So we want that appliance. We're just not there yet, and the infrastructure that we're building on, the internet as it is today, doesn't really do that. So we sort of have to either evolve it into a new internet that does do that well, or create another space where things happen. I was going to bring up the point about how the campus is probably, to me, the ideal example of what the internet needs to become, in the sense that within the campus, the campus has its firewalls to the internet and does or doesn't allow traffic into certain computers, and people within the campus have a help desk environment that they call when they have problems. But they also exert control that if a computer in the campus is doing some really bad stuff, then they'll disconnect it or block its address throughout the campus, and they regulate it, and it's there for the betterment of everybody that's using it in the diversity of ways that they're using it. But the at-home network or the Roadrunner network or the AT&T DSL-type networks don't see themselves as having to do that. They don't feel any responsibility over what the computers on their network are doing and what they may be doing to the rest of the internet. They make very little attempt at protecting their customers from what the internet could do to them. And that difference, to me, is one of the biggest things that we need to change, so that we should create communities of responsibility like the university does now, so that we can avoid the risks that the end user has to learn about as much as possible.
We have a caller here on our toll-free line in Nebraska. We'll go right there. Are you listening to us over the internet?
Absolutely.
Very good. Go ahead.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I teach at a university here, and I'm working on a collaborative project with some other people, and I give them access to files on my hard drive by assigning the directory permissions so that their usernames are allowed to access this folder. I'm running Windows 2000. Now, our computer folks here said that they detected the fact that I'd done this in a security sweep, and they said that that's not safe and that I should change it. So far, they haven't forced me to do so, but I expect they will soon. Can you tell me, I can't really get a straight answer from them about what the dangers are. Can you clarify this for me and what I can do about it?
I'm assuming you're giving them access via FTP or something?
No. I'm setting the folder permissions to allow access over the network.
So you're using Windows File Share.
Windows File Share.
Yeah. The problem is, there's a couple of problems. The first is that over that same connection that they're using to get access to your files, they can do a variety of other things that Windows supports using that, what we call it, a protocol. And unless you are auditing, there's a feature in your computer that would allow you to audit, and checking that auditing on a regular basis, you really wouldn't have any idea that they're doing this. And so they could be trying your own user ID against your computer, for example, to learn what your password is. Or they could be trying the administrator user ID to learn what its password is. The other problem is that how they're getting into you through whatever the gateway firewall might be, if you have one, if there's no blocking, if you're just open to the Internet, then this same thing could be occurring on lots of other computers inside your network.
We have a firewall, and everybody who's authorized to do so is operating from inside the network.
So you've gotten permission to have this facility open to your computer from the Internet.
Okay.
So it's really your own box that's at risk. It's not a high risk that you're presenting, other than your own data may get compromised. And if you are doing auditing, then you can control that. And if the corporate security people or the university security people have the ability to take your audit logs, then they could be including those as part of regular analysis. But it probably would be better to find another way to do that that is a bit more secure, and certainly FTP is not it, but using a web server with SSL set outside of your firewall and you transferring your files to there for sharing and people going there and downloading them based on authentication against the web server would be a far more secure way of doing what you're doing.
The problem is that it's database work that is being continually updated, and so more than one person would need access to it.
Because all these people update it?
Right.
And what security are you using to verify that they're providing you with the correct updates? Russ at rc.on.ca, and we'll happily walk through all of the problems, but this is a problem with security when you try and talk to the average person, and I don't mean the caller in particular, but in general, it isn't just one risk, you know?
Right. The problem is you say something that sounds absolutely right as far as I know, but I just get a blank look over my face.
Sure.
And think, what is he talking about? He's just lost me.
Right.
Oh, well. I think I'll hash it out with our folks here. But thank you. You did clarify it for me a little bit.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Sure.
We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I guess I did want to come back for a second to the issue of the firewall. We did talk about the fact that we're now saying that virtually everyone should have virus protection software on their computers. Anybody who does use the Internet, should anybody like that also have a firewall for their machine?
Russ, do you want to start?
Sure, definitely. I think, there's absolutely no harm in having a firewall on every computer on the planet. Marcus Ranham, who basically created Internet firewalls, and I had this debate about 3 years ago, and he strongly disagreed with me, but I think he's sort of come around. If nothing else, it alerts you to the threats that are out there at a bare minimum. And better than that, in most cases, it will prevent connections that you don't want to have happen. So definitely a zone alarm or a similar, I think Symantec makes a PC firewall as well, are both very reasonable products to use. Don't rely on them to protect you from absolutely everything and anything. I was reading about an Activision game the other day that would happily accommodate computers that were behind network address translation, which some people think is a form of security, and take both the hidden address and the public address and send them both up to the game server and put them together. And the whole idea of the network address translation is to stop that combination being put together. So you might run something on your computer that would totally make your firewall obsolete, but nevertheless, having it there is a great start.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Firewalls are useful tools, but they can create a false sense of security.
We're really just about the point we're going to have to stop. I'm sure that on another day we'll come back to some of this again, but I guess I'd like to say, is there anything that you'd like to, last thought that you'd like to leave with people before we end up going? Russ, maybe?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to everybody, and I just hope that your audience grows, because that shows that we're having an effect.
Okay. And if people are interested in investigating TruSecure and what you're all about, they just go to, I know you have a website.
www.trusecure.com, TRUSECURE.
Okay. And for people who are here on the campus who have computing questions, if they have some kind of a problem, they're not quite sure where to go or what to do.
They can start with the CCSO help desk, our resource center at 244-0608.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of you very much. Russ Cooper, Surgeon General at TruSecure, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
And here in studio, Bob Forsch and Mark Zinzo.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We appreciate it.